deduction for investment income. For some quick background, Washington's major business tax is the B&O tax, which is imposed on the gross receipts of business activities in the state without any deductions for the cost of doing business. A taxpayer may have more than one B&O rate, depending on the types of activities they conduct, and several preferential rates also apply to specific business activities. A B&O taxpayer may be eligible to utilize tax preferences, including credits and deductions, to reduce their tax liability. Currently, a B&O tax deduction is provided for amounts derived from investments, such as interest, dividends, and capital gains. The deduction is not available to a banking business, lending business, or security business. House Bill 1111 eliminates the B&O tax deduction for investment income for all taxpayers except for individuals. Investment income will then be taxed under the service and other activities classification. The bill takes effect October 1st, 2021. A fiscal note's available, and it is estimated to reduce state revenues by $42 million in the first biennium, by $54 million in the second biennium, for a total projected outlook of $96 million. Of this total, $90.8 million is from the general fund, with $5.2 million being from the Workforce Education Investment Account. Additionally, there's an estimated implementation cost of about $1.5 million in the first biennium and $1.6 million in the second biennium. That concludes my remarks for this bill, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions for staff on this one? If not, we will hear from the Good Prime sponsor, Representative Cody.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, it's Eileen Cody from the 34th District, and I believe this may be the first time I've ever been in front of the Finance Committee. I try and stay away from these topics as much as possible, but I will tell you that I brought this bill forward after the CARES Act funding was distributed last year, and I, pay a little attention to what's going on in healthcare, and read an article about the fact that the Providence Health System actually received more money in CARES Act funding than they lost in the first, this was on the second quarter when they got their money, that they had lost more in venture capital than they did in operating expenses, and that was the reason that they had received so much CARES Act money. And that kind of upset me to think that we were spending tax dollars on their investments, especially, thinking about venture capital. So I actually contacted staff to try and have a discussion about the fact that we should be getting some money on all of the different nonprofits' savings. And this does not tax their income. However they make their income, it is on the money that would be in their investments. I think that is only fair because, as you know, for those of us in healthcare, we have heard complaints through the years about the surpluses in the insurance companies, the hospitals. I know you're going to hear from the CCRCs, the long-term care, who we've had complaints from people that live in them about the fact that they loan, one continuing care group may loan money to start up another one and raise their rent. So it's the way the money gets slid around is hard for all of us to understand. And I just think that it's only fair that we would get some tax dollars off of those that revenue. I could probably come up with some other examples, but I don't think I need to belabor the point. That's what the bill's about.
Thank you so much, Rep. Cody. And are there any questions for the prime sponsor? If not, then I will suspend the hearing and say bye to Rep. Cody. Thanks so much for stopping by Finance. We'll suspend the hearing on HB 1111, and I will open the hearing on Substitute Senate Bill 5004, and we will start with a staff briefing. Thank you, Rochelle.
Thank you, Chair Berg. Substitute Senate Bill 5004 relates to sales of medical marijuana products. Oh, and apologies again for the record. My name is Rochelle Harris, committee staff. For some brief background, retail sales of marijuana products in Washington state are subject to an excise tax of 37%, which is in addition to state and local sales and use taxes. The revenues from the excise tax on marijuana products are deposited into the dedicated marijuana account. A Washington state resident may qualify for medical marijuana use if they are a patient of a healthcare professional, have been diagnosed with a terminal or debilitating medical condition, have been advised of the benefits and risks of marijuana use, and have been advised that they may benefit from the use of medical marijuana by their healthcare professional. The qualifying patient must either have authorization from their healthcare professional or must be entered into a medical marijuana authorization database and receive a recognition card from the state. Medical marijuana patients do pay the marijuana excise tax of 37% when purchasing marijuana products. With respect to retailers of marijuana products, marijuana retailers may apply to the Liquor and Cannabis Board for an endorsement to sell marijuana specifically for medical use to qualifying patients and their designated providers. Qualifying patients holding a recognition card are granted a sales tax exemption on certain medical marijuana products when sold by a marijuana retailer with one of these medical endorsements. The bill before you, Substitute Senate Bill 5004, provides that sales of compliant medical marijuana products by a retailer with a medical marijuana endorsement to qualifying patients or designated providers are exempt from the 37% excise tax on marijuana products until January 1st, 2025. The Joint Legislative Audit and Review Committee is directed to review the exemption to identify changes in consumer behavior and to determine whether the exemption results in unanticipated reductions in state revenue. JLEC will report its findings to the legislature by December 1st, 2024, and the bill overall takes effect January 1, 2022. A fiscal note is available, and the bill is estimated to reduce revenues to the dedicated marijuana account by an estimated $5,300 in the first biennium and by $5,500 in the second biennium. That concludes my remarks, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you so much. Is there any questions for staff? And if not, we will hear from the good prime sponsor, Senator Kaiser. Welcome. Oh, you're muted, Senator Kaiser. Sorry.
I'll never remember. Thank you very much, Vice Chair Berg and Vice Chair Waller. Good to be in front of the Finance Committee for my first time as well. I am State Senator Karen Kaiser from the 33rd Legislative District. The bill before you has a lot of history, and at least the two vice chairs are fairly new to the legislature. So I just want to go back about a decade when we actually originally approved medical marijuana for sale as a state, and medical marijuana stores started opening up. And that was kind of a Wild West time. We weren't really clear about what was going on and what we were doing. And things got a little bit, about every street corner had a medical marijuana store with all kinds of advertising. So we worked together in a bipartisan way to, the voters passed an initiative to allow for recreational marijuana as well as medical marijuana, to create a pretty solidly regulated market that would make sure that the products were carefully vetted and were accounted for. And when it came to medical marijuana, it got lost in the shuffle, to be honest. What happened was with the 37% excise tax that was added to the recreational product, the medical products became a bit of a loss to the retail market. Medical patients, many of them with brain cancer or glaucoma, a lot of senior citizens with arthritis, tended to avoid paying the 37% by using what you call the gray market, which isn't fully regulated. And people selling on the gray market, even out of their own home grows, may have used pesticides or other materials that would not be really appropriate for medical marijuana patients. So this effort before us is to get our medical marijuana patients into the system where they are purchasing Department of Health certified medical marijuana products that have a registry for the patient. So we have a system. It isn't back to street corner sales. We have a system, but they do get a break on the cost. It's important. You know, if a senior citizen buys a salve for their arthritis in their hands for $10, with the 37% excise tax added, that's, $13.70. That's quite hefty, not to mention the sales tax. So this bill simply gives medical marijuana patients a bit of a tax break and ensures that the system remains under some control.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Senator Kaiser. Are there any questions for the senator? With that, thank you so much for joining us in finance today. It's great to see you. And we will suspend the hearing on Senate Bill 5004, and I will hand back the gavel to our Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, we're ready to hear 5287.
5287. All right. Thank you so much, Madam Vice Chair. I think we will open the hearing then for 5287, starting with the staff briefing. I also don't have my notes in front of me, so don't know which specific staff member is ready to brief, but OPR, take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Nick Tucker, staff to the committee. In gross second substitute, Senate Bill 5287 expands and modifies the multifamily housing property tax exemption. By way of background, all property is subject to a tax each year based on the highest and best use, unless a specific exemption is provided by law. The multifamily housing property tax exemption, or MFTE, exempts real property associated with the construction, conversion, or rehabilitation of qualified multi-unit residential structures located in residential targeted areas, or RTAs, contained within an urban center. The tax exemption applies only to the value of the construction, conversion, or rehabilitation projects and does not exempt the value of the underlying property or other improvements on the property. The tax exemption on qualifying property lasts for 8 consecutive years. However, the exemption is extended to a 12-year period if the owner commits to renting or selling at least 20% of multifamily housing units as affordable housing to low and moderate income households. In the 2020 session, the legislature extended MFTE exemptions until December 31st, 2021 for properties receiving a 12-year exemption where that exemption was set to expire after June 11th, 2020, but prior to December 31st, 2021. To qualify for an exemption, the housing project must be located within an RTA designated by a qualifying county or city. Cities with a population of 15,000 or more may designate an RTA, and certain smaller cities are also eligible. Counties with an unincorporated population over 350,000 may also designate an RTA. Property owners seeking the exemption must apply to the city or county. The city or county may include additional eligibility requirements for the tax exemption. For purposes of the MFTE, affordable housing is housing for low to moderate income households that does not exceed one-third of the household's monthly income. Low-income households must have an income that is no more than 80% of the median income of their county. Moderate-income households must have an income between 80 and 115% of the median income for their county, and separate income thresholds apply to high-cost areas. Property owners are required to report certain information to the city or county, and the city or county must annually report to the Department of Commerce by December 31st of each year. A full summary of the MFTE program is available in the bill analysis in the EBB. In gross second substitute, Senate Bill 5287 expands and modifies the MFTE program in several ways. A property that qualified for and used an 8-year or 12-year exemption and is within 18 months of expiration may apply to extend the exemption for an additional 12 years if they meet locally adopted affordability requirements. To qualify, an applicant must be approved by the city or county and commit to renting or selling at least 20% of the housing units to low-income households. Until December 31st, 2031, the definition of city is modified to include any city. Until December 31st, 2024, a city not otherwise eligible to offer the MFTE program may offer the 12-year exemption to qualifying properties if certain density requirements are met. In addition, counties with an unincorporated population over 170,000 are eligible to designate an RTA. The definition of multiple unit housing is modified to include a group of buildings with 4 or more dwelling units. City or metropolitan statistical area median income may be used in addition to county median income to determine income thresholds. High cost areas and the associated income thresholds are removed from the program. A governing authority may adopt requirements that applicants pay prevailing wages, follow certain payroll requirements, utilize apprenticeships, or include a contracting inclusion plan developed in consultation with the Office of Minority and Women's Business Enterprises. An MFTE applicant must provide notice to tenants of rent-restricted units at the end of both the 10th and 11th years of the exemption period and must provide relocation assistance to qualified tenants in an amount equal to 1 month's rent at the time the exemption expires. To be eligible for the relocation assistance, a tenant must occupy an income-restricted unit and qualify as a low-income household. Property owners must file additional information with the city or county, including unit size, annual income, and household size. The city and county reporting deadline is moved to April 1st of each year. A city or county must comply with reporting requirements to offer tax exemptions under the program. Commerce must also provide an annual report on city and county compliance with the reporting requirements. At the conclusion of the exemption period, the value of the exempted property must be considered new construction for the tax property tax purposes, and no new exemptions may be granted on or after January 1st, 2032, and no extensions may be granted on or after January 1st, 2046. For preliminary or final applications submitted on or before February 15th, 2020, the city or county may choose to extend the deadline for completion for an additional 5 years. Additionally, the bill establishes a new 20-year exemption for properties that sell or rent 25% of the units to nonprofit organizations or local government partners that assure permanently affordable home ownership. permanently affordable home ownership units must be sold to households earning no more than 80% of the average median income for the city or local jurisdiction in which the unit is located. A local jurisdiction may collect a fee at each point of sale to cover administrative costs. Permanently affordable home ownership is housing sponsored by a nonprofit organization or local government that restricts resale to low and moderate income buyers and executes at least a 99-year ground lease or deed restriction with each sale. Commerce must develop a template for deed restrictions that can be used by local governments. Until December 31st, 2024, a city not otherwise qualified to offer the 20-year permanently affordable homeownership exemption may offer the 20-year MFTE to qualifying properties if the same certain density requirements are met. A preliminary fiscal note for the engrossed second substitute is available. State revenue impacts are indeterminate, as it is unknown how local jurisdictions may implement the bill. On the second substitute bill, the Department of Commerce estimated implementation costs of about $224,000 in the 21-23 biennium and of about $160,000 in the ensuing biennium, and I would anticipate similar costs on the engrossed bill. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Tucker? I am seeing no waving hands or Zoom hands raised. So that will go to our prime sponsor, Senator Doss. I think welcome back to the Finance Committee. I believe you've had a couple bills before us in years past. So welcome back and please tell us about your very good bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. It is lovely to be here with all of you. First time definitely testifying this year. So it's great to see all of you. And I know what happened when you heard the words, the letters MFTE. You might have had a little bit of groan. This bill has been around the legislature for a while. And I just want to just share good news that we are in a really good place with this bill. In fact, it passed off the Senate floor with 43 yay votes. So definitely very bipartisan bill. So I'm excited to tell you a little bit about how we got there. So I'll just say that, you know, I myself have been working on this bill with Rep. Whalen and Rep. Wallen and Rep. Rammel since session last year. We set to work, couldn't come to agreement last year, worked very hard over the interim, had dozens and dozens of stakeholder meetings with probably over 100 stakeholders. And the bill that, that you see before you now is a very well-worked, very crafted agreement between the Low Income Housing Alliance, the cities, as well as the builder. So I'm excited to share it with you all and have you all hear this bill today. I want to have a special shout out to Rep. Rammel. He and I worked very closely hand in hand over the interim to make sure that we had something that we could pass this year. Our goal was for everybody not to hate the bill, and we have come to that place where not everyone loves it, but most people really are proud of the work that we put forward on this bill. And I know, like my community, I'm sure many of your communities have been hit very hard with the pandemic on housing, and many Washingtonians are struggling to keep a roof over their heads. And as a renter myself, I've built a career in the mortgage industry helping connect families with home ownership, and I know how difficult it is to have affordable housing. And doing nothing makes it certain that we won't have more affordable housing. I'm committed to this, this policy and making sure it gets through the House as it did the Senate. Like I said, there's been a lot of work on this bill, and I want to thank all the stakeholders. There's a lot of, you know, and Nick did such a great job with the briefing. I just want to share some of the things that I'm excited about, the things that we worked through with the advocates, expanding the MFTE program to all cities. That was important to many of the my colleagues in the Senate. Also, we are establishing a new 20-year property tax exemption for the creation of permanent affordable housing, which is really great for folks like Habitat for Humanity that really build homes for our low-income community. Also, this bill will create tenant protections. This has been a criticism of the past of MFTE, making it really affordable. These tenant protections will allow a 12-year extension for the affordable units. And finally, if the developer decides not to re-up their MFTE program, it does provide relocation assistance for those in those units that will be affected. So I'm, again, really excited about the broad, diverse stakeholder group that went into this bill. I'm really happy that you all are hearing the bill. Thank you so much, Chair Frame. And I'm here for any questions.
Thank you so much, Senator Doss. I appreciate the levity around the groans around MFTE for those of us who were on the committee last year. And just appreciate sort of your candor and sort of describing how the bill has changed. I know we had some folks come late to the hearing today just because we're all around the Senate. So I encourage folks to go back and hear what Senator Doss had to say about sort of the journey this bill has taken. All right. I don't see any arms waving or Zoom hands up. So I don't think we have any questions. Thank you so much, Senator Doss. And with that, I think we're ready to move to public testimony. All right, Vice Chair Berg, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we will have our first group of testifiers. I'm going to call up Ryan Donahue. Let's see here. Let's go with actually Seth Dollab, Ryan Donahue, and Aiden Espino.
Sorry, this is Seth Darab. I just got transitioned over. Is it my time?
It is your time, Seth. Why don't you go ahead and go first? Perfect.
I apologize. Greetings. My name is Seth Darab. I'm Chief Administrative Officer of NextGen Housing Partners. We design, build, and manage several transit-oriented workforce housing buildings in Metro Seattle. Our existing projects, we have 45 units that are participating in the existing MFTE program. We have 17 more MFTE units that are under construction right now. The MFTE program is critical to our business. It influences our underwriting, our design, our financing. Our business is reliant on this program. And the new legislation is generally agreeable in concept to us. I'm here to ask for one small technical change that I've reached out to a few representatives on, and that is Section 5 of RCW 84.14.090, Section 5. And my request is to make that an emergency provision. I'm aware of a few projects that are in a similar status as mine, but I'll give you a brief explanation. We were 72% complete with construction going into the pandemic, and if it were not for the pandemic and the government mandated shutdown, our project would have been completed in summer of 2020. During the shutdown, we lost our subcontractors, we lost our key staff, we were forced to refinance, and it took months to get our feet back under us again. So we were thrilled to see this language added in the Senate on a bipartisan basis. However, if this law is enacted as is, and we have a 90-day waiting period after the end of the legislative session for it to take effect, we'll have a building that is basically complete that has to sit unoccupied and unleasable for 2 or 3 months, waiting for the law to take effect, waiting so the city of Seattle can then grant us the extension that will allow us to lease up our building. There's no public policy, there's no public good that happens from leaving our building empty. So I ask that the legislators consider making that provision take effect upon the governor's signature. My company is not Vulcan. We have a handful of employees. This section, this language is a lifeboat for our company and for our project. And we were profoundly shaken by the shutdown. And I'm sorry?
No, I was just saying thank you so much. We're almost to the end of your 2 minutes. We're actually,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And we'll hear from Ryan Donahue next. And we'll take questions at the end of this panel.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Chair Berg. Hello, Chair Frame, Ranking Member Orcutt, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ryan Donahue, and I'm the Advocacy and Policy Director for Habitat for Humanity, Seattle King County, providing affordable home ownership opportunities and home repair services across all of King and Kittitas counties. I'm here today to express our strong support for SB 5287 and the impact that it will have on housing in our communities. As an organization that currently utilizes the MFTE for homeownership projects, I wanted to briefly touch on a couple of the on-the-ground impacts of some of the changes that we particularly support with this bill. First off is the impact of the 20-year program. By creating this specific opportunity for permanently affordable homeownership, it makes it easier for organizations like us to make more use of the MFTE and pass those benefits on to homeowners. The impacts will be different for every project, but the reality is that on average, in King County, a family's going to save roughly $45,000 to $60,000 over the life of a mortgage. And that's real money, as you all know. Another change that can make that this bill makes that allows is that it allows for a broader assortment of projects to qualify for the MFTE. We have active or planned projects in neighborhoods and cities all across King and Kittitas counties, like Lake City, Loyal Heights, Capitol Hill, Renton, Magnolia, and so many others that could potentially qualify thanks to this bill, putting the dream of home ownership just a little bit more in reach for families all across Washington State. This tax exemption ultimately will help empower affordable housing organizations like Habitat and others, and will make a definitive step towards increasing our state's housing supply, which is so desperately needed. I thank you so much for your time, and I'm open to any questions you may have.
Thank you so much, Ryan. And before we hear from our next testifier, I want to call up our next panel. That'll be Brandon Morgan, Mackenzie Darr, and Greg Hannon. And next we'll hear from Aiden Espino.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Frame and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aiden Espino Jr. and I'm representing Habitat for Humanity of Washington State, which is the statewide association representing all Habitat affiliates, to testify in strong support of SB 5287. There has long been a lack of tools and support for affordable home ownership organizations like Habitat to aid in the mission of providing homeownership opportunities to low-income homebuyers. The addition of the 20-year exemption in particular provides a vital tool in the toolbox for organizations like ourselves to further expand homeownership opportunities. And this is because it helps pencil lower AMI projects and it expands into areas where Habitat affiliates, such as what Ryan was talking about in Seattle, King County, to utilize the tool and allows more types of projects to qualify. Considering the immense need for housing units to be developed, this exemption only empowers Habitat affiliates and similar organizations to serve our low-income homebuyers by helping save those families significantly over the course of their mortgage. With this tool, we can make a definitive step towards addressing the housing supply in the state and ensure that affordable homeownership projects are supported as a key aspect in the state's housing pipeline. And it's for those reasons that we strongly support SB 5287. Thank you.
All right, I see that we have some questions. Representative Harris-Talley, I saw your hand up first. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Freeman. I really thank this panel for consideration. In review of this bill, I represent the 37th, which I think is certainly a district in which this tool around affordability could be quite huge. Well, our consideration as a finance committee is, of course, the mechanism of the exemption. I'm just curious, I'm thinking through what overlap of implementation of this looks like, considering some of our zoning policies with a particular lens on racial equity and access, and just wondered if you all had some considerations there because of the urbanization consideration in the policy, and of course, sort of what we're up against with some of the zoning considerations about where these units can or can't be built. So just wanted some reflections there as we consider sort of who would have access to these tools. Thank you.
Anybody want to take a crack at that?
Well, go ahead, Ryan.
Go right ahead, Amy. I'll go after you.
I was going to say, on Habitat side here, on sort of the point on that I was making in empowering organizations like ourselves, I don't have the exact numbers in front of us, but the most recent numbers of our home buyers are primarily people of color. So having an additional tool for our organization to continue serving them, I think it directly addresses that sort of racial equity problem and housing especially, and especially for home ownership that I mentioned is a key aspect of our pipeline, right? That's how we view it, is that you kind of move on and hopefully you can own your own home. So that's, I think, that the 30-second answer I can give.
And Ryan, if you have something to add, go ahead. And Aiden, I will just say, if you end up getting some those numbers that you don't have in front of you, if you have them later and want to send them to us on the committee, we'd appreciate that very much. Ryan, go ahead, if you have anything to add.
First off, thank you very much, Representative Talley, for your question. I should say, as a proud member of your district, I am very happy that you asked that question. The only thing I would add on to that is also with the work that Habitat does, particularly, is we do take a, at least when it comes to gentrification and anti-displacement, we do make very strong efforts to avoid as much of that as humanly possible. We pretty much with every project that we're working on, at least, we're ensuring we use community preference points and other tools in order to make sure that the first people who get dibs, essentially, on the projects in a particular area are always either the people who actively live there at the time or the people who have historical ties to that community.
And then Representative Young, I see your hand up. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, to the Habitat for Humanity, Aiden or Ryan, you know, I've had some constituents recently contact my office that have had, or they're low income and are utilizing services provided through your organization. And unfortunately, they found themselves stuck in homes that are subpar now, dealing with black mold, a lot of other problems. And I wonder if you could speak to what your post services are after the property is provided to low-income, especially constituents of mine. I'm reticent to want to support a program like this if my low-income constituents are going to be stuck with lemons. So what do you guys do to help these people after they're in the home to make sure that the home is not only permanently affordable, but permanently healthy? Thanks.
Great. And Aiden, I see you nodding your head. If you want to go ahead and answer that, go for it.
Yeah, well, I could say a really big part of Habitat's services is sort of weatherization and rehabilitation of homes. That's something that I think I've talked to a handful of members in this committee and elsewhere, that, you know, it's one thing to empower and provide tools and support to build more units, but we also need to make sure that we can support the units that currently exist or the homes that currently exist, such as these Habitat homes. So while it's very unfortunate to hear, and I'd love to talk with you, Representative Young, offhandedly, maybe about the specifics and maybe get that sorted out. What I could say is that we want to make sure that, you know, the people, especially seniors that are in Habitat homes or elsewhere, can have a healthy home and age in place, stay in their homes.
Great. All right, thanks so much, Aiden. I see additional questions. Representative Chop, go ahead with your question. Rep Chop, you are muted. There you go.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. This program is going on for many years, and out of the total number that are units that are affected by this, what percentage or what number total is actually dealing with Habitat for Humanity?
Great question. Either one of you have an answer to that? I kind of feel like what I feel like I heard was that the new provision allows you guys to participate in it more, but do you already have units through MFTE now?
Thank you very much for the question. I would say we do have some projects already active, actually in King County, and actually more specifically, both in the city of Seattle, which has we've done a great job working with them, as well as a project in Burien, or I should say a proposed project. I don't think it's been 100% all the way approved yet, but we're pretty darn close, I believe, on that one. Would actively, or that are, you know, likely to be receiving essentially the program as it exists now. As far as it exists in the future, as I think, you know, most of the projects that we do, at least in Seattle, King County, end up needing to be, we end up seeing a density component as a significant part of the project. So, I mean, the reality is, you know, we don't build the single family home with the white picket fence really so much anymore. Almost always it's doing duplexes or triplexes or quadplexes, or to be honest, even in your district, Representative, a condo project that we're looking to launch here shortly. You know, it'd be projects like that that we'd be looking to utilize this tool for.
Do you have a quick follow-up question after that?
Just quickly, I had to testify on a bill in Senate. That's why I was late, so I apologize for that, Chair Frame. So I can maybe get this information from staff. I need to know a bunch more information about it, and specifically what number of units in the past has been utilized by Habitat for Humanity. I think Habitat for Humanity is well-respected, and it's got a good public purpose, and it's a nonprofit developer, as far as I can tell, and to provide homeownership for individual families. That's very meritorious. But the percentage of these units are very small, probably going to that purpose. So the follow-up question is, would you have a problem if this program was just dedicated to Habitat for Humanity type projects?
So let's take this follow-up conversation offline, just because I know how many more folks we have to sign in wishing to testify. And I want to make sure we get to them, but these are good questions. And I know Rep Chop, Senator Doss had a good opening kind of explaining sort of some of the journey the bill has taken. So I think that's worth following up on as well. All right, let's keep going on public testimony. Vice Chair Berg, let me turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our next panel will start with Brandon Morgan.
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brandon Morgan. I'm Development Director at Vulcan Real Estate in Seattle and testifying in support of Senate Bill 5287. Vulcan supports the MFT program, one of its biggest fans. We want to see it continue to help middle-income tenants who fall outside the reach of nearly every state and federal subsidy program, because this is the segment of the low-income spectrum that's typically 60 to 85% of median, and most of those programs tend to serve the 60 and below percent AMI population. So this is one of the few, if only, effective tools we have that serves that segment of the low-income housing spectrum, leveraging the private sector to do that. And thanks to MFTE, Vulcan's produced about 300 MFTE units all in the city of Seattle to date, although we're planning to expand to other jurisdictions as well soon. Since about 2006. We've got another 200 in the pipeline in Seattle, planned to continue to include those in most of our projects. So from our vantage point, the program's working. It's addressing an overlooked segment of our spectrum and the housing spectrum, and we support its expansion. And then we think this bill allows us to do that. We appreciate the time that was put into the bill by Representative Rommel and Representative Wallen, Senator Doss, and other stakeholders, and we're encouraged that the product before you now provides a little more time to study some of the more contentious provisions that could tip the single most effective tool we have to a disincentive that developers might pass up. This complex housing issue, it kind of involves a delicate balancing act. Our long experience with the program in Seattle illustrates it's important to provide local jurisdictions enough flexibility to craft and refine their program within the state parameters that you set. And Seattle, for example, about 40% of new multifamily units elect to use the program in Seattle. It's different from every jurisdiction, but we're pleased that this bill helps protect those units and allows more cities to enter the program and have the flexibility to adopt those program parameters and best practice based on their individual goals for housing in their jurisdiction.
Thank you so much, Brendan.
That's all I have to say. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Next, we're going to hear from Mackenzie Darr.
Good afternoon. My name is Mackenzie Darr, and I'm a development manager with the Wolf Company, a market rate multifamily developer.
And Mackenzie,
Wolf has developed 185 affordable housing units through purchase.
Mackenzie, do you want to turn on your
camera? Yeah, I apologize. I actually just moved and don't have a desk yet.
Oh, no worries.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Thank you. The MFTE program the MFTE program meets multiple legislative priorities through increasing the production of affordable housing, furthering the goals of the GMA by enabling denser development, and by serving as an economic development tool, spurring housing production and infrastructure investment in communities that may not otherwise attract new market rate development. The current program is an effective public-private partnership tool, and the proposed legislation provides important tools to expand on the success of the existing program. In particular, the proposed legislation provides the option to extend participation in the MFTE program for an additional 12 years and expands the number of eligible jurisdictions. enabling the preservation and designation of a substantial number of additional affordable housing units. Programs like this are necessary to help Washington meet the incredible demand for housing, particularly the missing middle workforce housing. Again, I'd like to echo Brandon. While I'm excited to see the legislature taking action to increase housing affordability, I would like to urge elected officials at the local and state levels to continue to monitor the program to ensure that it's being actually utilized by private developers so that this actually continues to meet the stated intent of the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And before we hear from our next testifier, I want to call up Paul Jewell, Nathan Daum, Carl Schroeder, and Michelle Thomas. And next we'll hear from Greg Hannon.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Hannon, representing NAOT, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, and speaking in support of Senate Bill 5267. Our members partner with local governments to implement the MFTE program. We do appreciate being part of the interim stakeholder process, as well as the many discussions during the legislative session. MFTE is an effective tool that has produced thousands of units of below market rate housing for working families and individuals who make less than the area median income. MFTE addresses the need for workforce housing to allow hospitality, healthcare, education, and other workers to live near employment centers and transit. And while we understand the give and take of the legislative process, and we do support the bill before you, there is one element I want to bring to your attention that could well reduce the workability of the incentive and decrease program participation. And that is the requirement for tenant relocation assistance when a building nears the end of the tax exemption period. This creates additional costs to building owners that was not present when the pro forma for the building was created. We cannot predict what this added cost means regarding future participation, but we will know when we see how the market reacts to this new requirement. Thank you for your time today.
Rep. Harris Talley, I see you have your hand up. Go ahead with your question. I think that was this entire panel, right, Vice Chair Berg? Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Rep.
Oh, thank you, Chair Freeman. I was trying to stay with the panel guidance, Rep. Berg, so I'm glad I hit it. Curious for both Vulcan and you, Mr. Hannon, with considerations of the units that you're currently building as private developers. I know, for instance, Vulcan has a building that just opened in the heart of the Central District with 200 plus units. Of the affordability that's offered, how much is sort of being referred to folks to stay in place or return to place? It's something that's come up often in my district, and I'm just curious if you have a sense of how many folks have been displaced versus being able to come back with the affordability of units that are already being built in any projects that you have. Thank you.
So I represent the association, and the two representatives that are on my panel are actually participants in the program. So Mackenzie, can I ask if you might have any insight into that particular question, and Brandon?
I can answer first.
I'll let you go, Brandon.
Okay. Representative Harris-Talley, you're referring to, I think, our Jackson project, which was just delivered at 23rd Jackson, the Central District. That has a little over 100 MFTE units in it. And yes, there has been some affirmative marketing done to folks in the neighborhood. I can provide you more details about that and what our success has been offline, if you'd like.
That would be wonderful. And I would love to know if it's known, the demographic makeup, because I think certainly for historically Black places like the Central District, that's part of the consideration, certainly not just affordability,
sure.
But who's returning or staying in the communities. Thank you.
Sure.
Great. So let's do all the rest of that follow-up offline. I'm going to encourage us to move forward, and we've had a lot of questions on this bill. We are running out of time. We have three other bills we need to hear today. So let's go ahead and move on to our last panel. And try to limit questions and instead do them offline, and then we'll move on to our other three bills today. It's been a good, robust discussion, but I want to keep moving. All right, thanks, Vice Chair Berg. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do want to warn this panel, I'm going to cut you off at 60 seconds, so we're going to start with Paul Jewell. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Madam Vice Chair and Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Jewell, on behalf of the Washington State Association of Counties. I'll shorten my testimony. We're really pleased to be in support of this bill today. We're happy that It expands it to counties with an unincorporated population of over 170,000. That includes Clark, King, Kitsap, Pierce, and Snohomish counties. We do have other counties, however, who would like access to this program. We would like to see it actually extended to really any GMA planning county who designates urban growth areas. These are areas that are supposed to be built to an urban standard and can support multifamily housing. We think it's an appropriate use of this particular program. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions or provide further information if needed.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. Next is Nathan Baum.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nathan Baum. I'm the Economic Development Manager for the City of Shoreline. I'm testifying in support of 5287. We're committed in Shoreline to addressing the root causes of the regional homeless and affordability crisis, supporting a shelter located right in the center of our commercial district, including a rezoning effort to support that. We're providing a $3.5 million piece of land for a 99-year ground lease for a new housing with supportive services. But really, primarily, MFTE has been our main vehicle for affordable housing. We've had 9 buildings, total of 1,200 units. We have another 8 buildings with 1,400 units, including an estimated 670 affordable units that are in the pipeline now under development. We offer only the 12-year MFTE. We did have one program in the 8-year prior to that, but at this time, we only offer the 12-year. Our affordability levels in Shoreline are 70% AMI for studios and one bedrooms and 80% AMI for two bedroom or larger. We're seeking an amendment to this bill to enable our 99-year affordability requirement that we have for all buildings in our station areas. We currently require that of any new multifamily building within our highest density areas adjacent to our two future light rail stations. We've had zero development of multifamily in those zones despite the extremely hot market of the last 5 years. We have had no apartment buildings built there, and there are many barriers to that. And we are seeking the extension to 20 years of the MFTE to enable that 99-year affordability.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And you can enter your testimony as written as well, just so you know. And Carl Schroeder is next.
Thank you, Vice Chair Berg, members of the committee. Carl Schroeder with the Association of Washington Cities here in support of this compromise bill as well. The framework that we agreed on with the other parties was to take the issues that we could make progress on and move those forward in policy. And then some of the issues that have been bedeviling us for the last several years to try to get better data and develop recommendations for the legislature moving forward. So, for instance, Representative Harris-Talley, your questions about displacement and gentrification and how we can make sure this tool is not contributing to those. That's exactly the sort of thing that we intend to study and bring back recommendations on. The ability to preserve these existing income-restricted units is really important. From 2019 to 2029, we have 7,000 or so of those that are subject to reverting to the market, and we think it's important to be able to preserve those. We also appreciate the extension of this to the smallest cities in the state for the first time. And I'll leave it at, it's important to cite this program in the continuum of the housing support that states and local governments are doing. We do a great deal of work with the Housing Trust Fund, the Low Income Housing Tax Credit, and other programs at the local level to focus at the lowest incomes. This is one of the best and only tools that we have to focus on densification and moderate income workforce housing. So appreciate your support and open for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And last we'll have Michelle Thomas.
Hi, I'm Michelle Thomas with the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance. I've signed an other today because there was an agreed upon amendment regarding the requirement for tenant relocation assistance, which got a little fumbled in the Senate. We're withholding our support for the bill until that's fixed over here in the House. As you know, this bill, this issue, and this program is really fraught. I deeply appreciate the work that Senator Doss, Representative Ramel, and Representative Wallen have all done for over a year to try to bring all stakeholders to the table to reach compromise. Our concerns about the underlying program and impacts on gentrification and displacement have been seriously considered by these lawmakers. While I can't say that the bill has fully addressed these concerns, I am convinced that this bill currently reflects the most compromise possible. There are some good things about it, in addition to the relocation assistance, which again needs to be fixed. Additionally, though, the permanent program is a great addition. We appreciate that the expansion to other jurisdictions does not include the 8-year program. The allowable AMIs for the affordable units have been lowered for the whole program. And lastly, we greatly appreciate that the whole program, that whole underlying program expires in 10 years. That's great. Once again, though, I just want to emphasize an agreed upon amendment is in the works. Once that is done and attached to the bill, we would recommend a do pass vote. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And that concludes our testimony, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Berg. Any questions for this panel before we wrap up? All right, seeing none. Vice Chair Berg, do we have any folks to read into the record that we're not wishing to testify?
We do. We have 21 not wishing to testify, 20 pro and 1 con.
All right. And with that, we will close the hearing on, wow, engrossed second Senate substitute bill 5287. That's a mouthful. Close that up. And we will open the hearing with engrossed Senate bill 5220, starting with a staff briefing from Tracy O'Brien. Ms. O'Brien, take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tracy O'Brien, staff to the committee. Engrossed Senate Bill 5220 relates to the taxation of salmon recovery grants. And since you guys are familiar with both the B&O tax and the retail sales and use tax, I will skip that part of my briefing and go right to the actual parts of the bill. Under this bill, a retail sales tax exemption is provided to qualifying grants made by federal, state, tribal, and local governments for salmon habitat restoration. The existing B&O tax exemption is expanded to include grants received by a nonprofit organization from tribal governments. Under the bill, a salmon recovery grant is defined as financial assistance provided to primarily benefit the public as a whole by renewing, restoring, or protecting salmon ecosystems or habitats by human intervention. Exemptions authorized by this act are exempt from the requirements of the tax preference performance statement, JLARC review, and the automatic 10-year expiration. The bill has an emergency clause, making it effective immediately upon the governor's approval. There's a fiscal note available in your DB. The bill affects approximately 200 taxpayers. There is an indeterminate impact on the B&O collections due to the expansion of the B&O exemption to tribal governments. The fiscal note assumes that beginning July 1st, 2021, all salmon habitat restoration grant proceeds will be used as following. 15% of the grant money to nonprofit grant recipients acting as a contractor, 85% of to construction-related expenses. As a result, it is estimated that the bill decreases state sales and use tax revenues by an estimated $3.7 million in the 21-23 biennium, $8.1 million in 23-25. In addition, local sales and use tax revenues would decrease by $1.6 million in 21-23 and $1.8 million in 23-25. The Department of Revenue estimates expenditures of $110,000 in 21-23, with the majority being spent in fiscal year 22. They also anticipate expenses of approximately $10,000 in 23-25. That concludes my remarks.
All right. Thanks so much, Ms. O'Brien. So, Ms. O'Brien, we're having a pretty hard time hearing you. So, if folks have questions, I would just refer you to like the fiscal note. I missed a bunch of numbers in there. It was cutting in and out. So, if folks have questions about the fiscal, I'd just say just pull it up on the publicly available website. But if folks had substantive questions for Ms. O'Brien, now would be the time. But I don't see any hands, but I do see a prime sponsor. So, Senator Vandaway, welcome to the House Finance Committee. Would you like to tell us about your very good bill today?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's great to see everybody. I'm Kevin Vandewijk from the 24th Legislative District, the beautiful Olympic Peninsula. And it's lovely to see all these smiling, great faces in front of blue screens. Thank you for hearing this bill. And I just want to start off my testimony by saying this was legislation that was passed in 2004, where the legislature at that time decided to exempt salmon restoration projects from B&O and sales tax. And that, I think, was an acknowledgement of a lot of things. Certainly, it was acknowledgement of our tribal partners. We owe it to them, and we owe it, I think, to Washington State to ensure the restoration of salmon. And a lot of the projects that are capital budget funds and local governments fund have that as a goal in mind. Over time, though, over the last 17 years, kind of the what exactly that means for a salmon project, if you don't have to pay taxes, has kind of gotten a little muddled. And I see Representative Orca; he probably was here in 2004, maybe even remembers the bill. But so DOR has said, you know what, some of these projects we're thinking might actually owe some taxes. So this bill really is a clarification of that older legislation that exempted these projects from sales and B&O tax. So yes, there is a fiscal note involved. I think the Senate budget essentially didn't pay attention to it though, because this is money that we have not collected. Sure, if this bill dies and doesn't get passed and signed into law, DOR might start collecting some sales tax, but this money has not been collected in the past. So I wanna be sure to point that out. And I wanna be sure to point out that this is something that will help our tribal partners and our salmon restoration efforts statewide. It was, I think, well-crafted in the Senate by Senator Rolfes helped write it, and it had good support, and I hope it has good support here in the House.
All right. I'm looking at you, Orca. Do you remember it in 2004? Because you were here. This is a fun story Orcutt and I have, Senator Bandaway. So thank you for reminding us.
Yes,
all right. Any questions for our prime sponsor? All right. With that, Senator, thank you so much for joining us today. We will move over to public testimony. Vice Chair Berg, take it away.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. The first folks we'll hear from are Nicholas Norton and Michael Bailey.
Chair Frame, Vice Chair Berg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nick Norton, and I'm the Executive Director of the Washington Association of Land Trusts. On behalf of our 32 member land trusts across the state, here testifying in strong support of SB 5220. Many of our land trusts in Puget Sound and well beyond routinely access grant funding to help protect and restore salmon habitats and ecosystems for the public benefit. In addition, we often work hand in hand with other nonprofit entities like regional fisheries enhancement groups on these projects, who you hear from in a second. This routinely involves multiple funding sources from local, state, tribal, and federal sources, as well as combinations of direct and indirect grants over long timeframes. In 2019, nonprofits learned we were apparently subject to retail sales as well as B&O tax for some of the grants, despite different guidance from our grant-making agencies and existing exemptions for salmon restoration work that Senator Vandoy alluded to. SB 5220 provides a series of critical clarifications we need as conservation practitioners, better accommodates the complex nature of conservation finance, and helps ensure that the already limited funding for vital salmon recovery efforts goes towards its intended public purpose. We appreciate the efforts of the Department of Revenue in working closely with us and other stakeholders to develop this important piece of legislation, and are really grateful to Senator Vandoy for making this a priority. We kindly ask the committee to advance this legislation. Thank you.
Great. We will hear from Michael Bailey next.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Ranking Member Orcutt, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Bailey, and I currently serve as a legislative liaison here at the Washington Department of Revenue. I'm here today to support our agency request legislation, Senate Bill 5220. We'd like to thank Senator Vandeweghe for sponsoring the agency request legislation and for bringing the bill forward. The Department of Revenue understands that state, local, and federal government agencies fund a number of habitat restoration or enhancement projects throughout Washington State. These governmental entities often provide funding to nonprofit conservation organizations that, in turn, are responsible for coordinating or facilitating these projects. The funding may be in the form of a grant award in advance of a particular project or other financial assistance. Generally, organizations, including nonprofits, are required to remit B&O tax or public utility tax on gross income unless a specific exemption or deduction applies. In some cases, grants may also be subject to retail sales tax. Because government grant funds are generally considered gross income, they too are subject to taxation under current law. In 2018, the agency issued an interim statement to address the tax responsibilities of nonprofit conservation organizations coordinating or facilitating habitat restoration projects that were funded by government entities. The guidance essentially affirmed the previous statement, but also told these entities to hold off on paying the tax until the legislature had an opportunity to provide direction on the matter. With that being said, the interim statement will remain in effect until June 30th of this year. So the legislation before you serves as a vehicle for essentially providing that direction, and was informed by many of the stakeholders that you see here today, including our sponsor. Specifically, Senate Bill 5220 would do three things. One, provide an exemption from sales tax for the receipt of qualifying salmon restoration grants that are deductible
from the state BNO tax. Two, it would clarify the use of salmon restoration grant funds by the grantee to purchase tangible personal property or specified services, that those would still be subject to sales tax. And three, it would also update the BNO tax deduction for the salmon restoration grants to include amounts received from federally recognized tribes. And because the department understands the evolution of grants, the use of sub-grantees and their agreements, this legislation also provides clarity on how the department is to interpret grants and nonprofits when applying this exemption. So we recommend this bill to you and respectfully request your support. Madam Chair and Vice Chair, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you so much. And that concludes the testimony of this first panel. If there are no questions, we will move on to our second panel. First, we'll hear from Bryn Brady.
Good afternoon, Chair Frame, Ranking Member Orcutt, and members of the committee. My name is Bryn Brady, and I am the lobbyist for the Regional Fisheries Coalition. This group is comprised of 14 Regional Fishery Enhancement Groups, or RFEGs, that are located regionally throughout the state and charged with restoring habitats and enhancing salmon populations. The legislation before you clarifies the types of grants and the type of work related to those grants that will continue to be exempt. I have other testimony, but I'm just going to cut to the chase because the others have eloquent, Mr. Norton and Mr. Bailey have eloquently addressed the issues, but I just want to emphasize that the intent of the 2004 legislation hasn't changed, but rather the projects supported by the grants aren't as simple as they used to be. Mr. Bailey referred to it as an evolution, and that is definitely indeed the case of how grants are assembled to carry out these projects, as well as the contract agreements to carry out the work. Those have all evolved since 2004. I'm gonna now defer my time to two members, two RFEGs that are with you here today, one from the Hood Canal area and another one from Walla Walla. And they can better illustrate to you exactly how they are bringing this grant work forward and carrying out the intent of restoring salmon populations in our state.
Great, thank you so much. Next, we'll hear from Brian Burns.
Okay, good afternoon, Finance Committee. My name is Brian Burns. I'm the Executive Director of the Tri-State Steelheaders, coming to you from Walla Walla this afternoon. We're the Regional Fisheries Enhancement Group serving Southeast Washington. Grants are critical to our work in salmon recovery because of the size and complexity, and therefore the expense of the projects that we sponsor. This year, we have a $2.5 million grant-funded fish passage project scheduled for construction. In 2021, our organization has six active grant contracts with the Recreation and Conservation Office that will result in about a half mile of fish passage in the Mill Creek Flood Control Channel. Will also lead to construction-ready plans for another half mile in that Mill Creek Flood Channel, and also result in about a half mile of habitat improvements constructed on the Walla Walla River. These grants are matched by about $500,000 in partners cost share from the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, Bonneville Power Administration, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and funds through the Regional Fisheries Enhancement Group program. At this level of funding, it's critical for us that all the grant funds go to implementing projects. A tax of 1.5% on our 2021 grants would be the equivalent of the salary and benefits of our project manager who oversees these projects.
Thank you so much, Mr. Burns. If you could just one last sentence, maybe.
Thank you for giving me the time and for the opportunity to voice support of your legislation.
Perfect. Thanks so much. Next, we'll hear from Mindy Harlow.
Good afternoon. I'm Mindy Harlow with the Hood Canal Salmon Enhancement Group. I'm the executive director of that organization, and I first want to thank the DOR and the legislature for working to clarify this tax exemption application and for this opportunity to speak on behalf of supporting this bill. It's great to see the bill's language takes into account how grants and habitat projects have changed over the years. With many of the low-lying fruit projects already completed, organizations like mine are taking a larger and more complex projects that involve multiple partners and multiple funding sources. The Hood Canal Salmon Enhancement Group has been working on habitat restoration throughout the Hood Canal since 1990. Over the past 20 years, our efforts have been focused on ESA-listed Hood Canal summer chum. We currently have 12 state grants under contract for 2021. The state agencies funding these salmon habitat restoration projects include RCO, Department of Fish and Wildlife, DOE, and Department of Agriculture. These grants total millions of dollars in state funds that are leveraging millions of other dollars in federal funds to meet the state's salmon recovery goals. Given the fact that the many salmon species are teetering on the brink of extinction, it is critical that all funds go toward the implementation of projects that will help restore salmon populations through Washington State. On top of all the dollars that come from our state and federal sources, organizations like mine work with thousands of volunteers to complete our restoration projects. For example, in 2020, our group had 1,175 individual volunteers who volunteered 10,571 hours to our work throughout the Hood Canal. We find that this strategy of recruiting volunteers not only develops community support for the work that we do, but also helps us make sure that our restoration dollars go even farther towards the state's salmon recovery goals. So again, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. And Madam Chair, that concludes our testimony.
All right, and I don't see any waving arms or Zoom hands. So I think we are done. Madam Vice Chair, any folks to read into the record?
Yes, 44 not wishing to testify and all 44 in support.
All right. All right, with that, we will close the hearing for Engrossed Senate Bill 5220. Let's reopen the hearing for Substitute Senate Bill 5004 and go to public testimony, as we've already had a briefing and heard from our prime sponsor. Madam Vice Chair Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to call up Ezra Eckmeyer, Laura Kaminsky, Danielle Rawlinson, and Hannah Guerrero. Sorry about those pronunciations. Go ahead, Ezra.
Okay. Hi. Thank you for this time to testify from my bedroom in Kingston. I am Ezra Eichmeyer, representing Producers Northwest. I cannot say enough in support of this legislation. You know, originally, the whole reason the legislature chose to specifically apply the cannabis tax to medical patients was because of fear about medical cannabis patients, or excuse me, about fear of the general public gaming the system and getting, you know, fraudulent medical marijuana authorizations so that they could get a tax break at the retail stores. However, back in 2015, we got a bunch of provisions into the medical marijuana statutes specifically to permanently prevent that kind of behavior. I actually helped craft those provisions, and they're very, very effective. And they have eliminated that concern entirely. It would be almost impossible for people to have it be worth their time economically to make such a move. So now we're looking at a scenario where people who have very severe medical conditions who may need very high levels of cannabis products are being taxed the same as somebody who, you know, just wants to, you know, use cannabis for, you know, whatever reasons. And it's just not humane. You know, if somebody's dying from cancer, we don't want to be taxing part of their medicine, especially some of the more expensive stuff, at 37%. It's just not okay. This bill would address that. It also, as somebody who's in the cannabis industry, this would spur a bunch of economic development because it would make it economically viable for our companies to start actually investing in research on, you know, next generation medical cannabis products. So please, 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 please pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we'll hear from Laura.
Thank you very much, Chair Frame and members of the committee. My name is Laura Kaminsky, and I am the Government Affairs Liaison for the Cannabis Alliance. We are here testifying in strong support of 5004. As you heard in the staff briefing, under state law, all retail cannabis sales are subject to a 37% excise tax, regardless of if the purchaser is a patient or not. We have conducted surveys to determine how patients are feeling about the regulated system. In those surveys, patients consistently indicate that half of them are staying out of the regulated market completely because it does not service their needs. The top three reasons they state are the cost, the fear of inadequate testing, and the lack of appropriate products in the store. Department of Health compliant products are the only highly tested products that meet the concern that patients have regarding safety, but there's a serious lack of these products in the market. And the cost of the few products that are compliant with DOH standards, with the 37% excise tax, is far out of the range of chronically ill patients who are disproportionately poor and whose need is generally greater. This legislation removes the 37% tax only on those highly tested DOH compliant products and only to patients registered in the database. This change on a small segment of the market goes a long way to address the top three reasons patients are not accessing the regulated market. Additionally, I just want to take a moment to address the amendment that was added in the Senate, sunsetting the exemption after a report by JLARC. We are in full support, as we understand there may still be concerns about tax loss, even with the very low fiscal note. We may, however, want to add an additional amendment to extend the sunset to June of 2025 versus January. This is to prevent a gap in the relief to patients should the report be favorable and the exemption be made permanent. Thank you very much. And with that, I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you so much. And next we'll hear from Danielle.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me today. My name is Danielle Rosellison. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Trailblazin Productions, a cannabis farm in beautiful Bellingham. 100% of the product that Trailblazin produces is DOH certified, so it's known as medical marijuana. Out of 1,500 licensed producer processors, Trailblazin is one of two that certify all of our products as medical. I'm here today to ask you to support SB 5004 with the intention of increasing Department of Health compliant products on the market. I'm keeping this short because I know we're tight on time, but a couple of reasons why. It's really expensive to grow medical products and it's expensive to test medical products. And the current ROI doesn't pencil for a number of reasons, which I'm working on with JLARC. Passing 5004 will make sure that retailers understand what DOH products are and that more patients and veterans in need will ask for DOH products, which then means more producers and processors will certify their products as medical. Currently, registered patients only get sales tax off their cannabis purchases. However, the burden is such that every retailer I know just gives anybody who says that they're a patient 10% off. This leads many patients and veterans to purchase whatever is suggested, which may or may not be in the best interest of the patient. Passing 5004 will make sure that patients and veterans have affordable access to their medicine. Patients and veterans are often also on fixed incomes, like Lara said, but they need the best quality products for their health. This is about affordable healthcare. And finally, did you know that there is no requirement for medical marijuana endorsed stores to have certified medical marijuana? Passing 5004 will ensure that medical marijuana endorsed stores, at a very minimum, know about medical marijuana and likely will carry it in their for their patients and needy veterans. Please pass 5004.
Thank you so much. And next we'll hear from Hannah.
Hello. I would like to begin with a thank you to the chair and members. The committee. My name is Hannah Keith Guerrero. In July 2019, I was diagnosed with an anaplastic astrocytoma 3, an aggressive and recurrent form of third grade brain cancer. I will continue to have surveillance MRIs every 3 months for the rest of my life. I'm 29 years old. After a complete resection, I discovered my brain functioned differently than before surgery. I struggle with complications from seizures, memory, language, and my nervous system. The changes in my nervous system have been especially difficult because I react more strongly to stressors, cannot control my moods, nor my anxiety. After surgery, I became dependent on Social Security disability and have been unable to work due to treatment and its long-term resulting effects during COVID. I rely on several programs such as free healthcare and food assistance services. I also have a little financial help from a parent. Nonetheless, I barely have enough money for rent and utilities, let alone the cost of medicinal cannabis. After surgery, another anaplastic astrocytoma 3 brain cancer patient connected me to support programs like SMJ Consulting and Ames Institute here in Seattle. Through these programs, I learned medicinal cannabis is clinically proven to specifically help brain cancer patients by inhibiting the growth of cancerous brain cells. I also discovered that microdosing medicinal cannabis significantly helps me manage my symptoms. It helps me go through each day without crippling anxiety, heavy mood swings, and mental breakdowns that may otherwise make it difficult to do something so simple, excuse me, as leave my apartment. Even with the incredible amount of support I'm lucky to receive, the cost of medicinal cannabis is a financial strain, and I rely heavily on credit cards to help cover the cost.
The main reason I have been able to access this literally life-saving medicine is because of the support of programs with organizations like SMJ Consulting. I cannot emphasize the importance of this medicine in my daily life and how important it is for improving and extending the quality and longevity of my life. The bill will make a huge impact for me and my life by reducing the cost of highly tested medicinal cannabis, something I rely on to survive. I urge you to please pass this important piece of legislation. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Sorry about all the tears. Also.
Oh, you're fine. Thank you so much. And Madam Chair, that concludes our testimony.
Great. Yeah, Hannah, thank you so much. I know that that's clearly not easy, and we're just really grateful for you being here today. So thank you for sharing your story. I do see one question from Representative Chase. We definitely were at time for this bill, so let's make the question quick, and then Vice Chair Berg will read into the record who didn't want to testify, and then we're going to move on to our last bill. So Rep. Chase, go ahead with your question.
Okay, it's probably for Danielle. I've only got one prescription, and I never look at the receipt. Are other prescriptions taxed in Washington State? Just medical marijuana?
Yes, only medical marijuana is taxed. No other medicine is usually taxed.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. All right, Vice Chair Berg, do we have any folks read into the record?
We do. We have 62 folks who did not want to testify, 61 pro, and one other.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for your time today. With that, we will close the hearing on Substitute Senate Bill 5004. And we will reopen the hearing on House Bill 1111. We've already had a staff briefing and a prime sponsor introduction. So we'll go to public testimony. Vice Chair Berg.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to start with Sam Hatzenbeller and Stacey Jones. And let's just start there.
Good afternoon. Is it my turn?
Go ahead, Sam. Yep. Thanks.
Good afternoon. I'm Sam Hatzenbeller with the Economic Opportunity Institute in support of House Bill 1111, ending a tax loophole on corporate investment income and instead using the revenue to fund basic public health and healthcare services for struggling Washingtonians will help ensure a faster recovery from the pandemic and economic recession. The majority of businesses that invest, particularly those that invest in the stock market, are very well-off companies, not small family-owned businesses. Take large hospital chains, for example. While hospital representatives may claim the pandemic has thrown them into financial chaos, some hospitals, in fact, have substantial financial reserves that generate large returns on Wall Street. A New York Times expose revealed that one hospital chain in our state has received more than $500 million of pandemic assistance in 2020, even while it guards reserves of over $12 billion. This hospital chain also collects around $1 billion per year from its hedge fund investments and venture capital firms, none of which is currently taxed in Washington. When a hospital chain like this can pay its CEO a salary of $10 million and pay zero in federal taxes due to its nonprofit status, while at the same time laying off workers and botching vaccine delivery by preferencing high-level donors over vulnerable community members, we have a problem. This bill takes a step towards correcting that problem. While profits for large hospital chains have skyrocketed during the pandemic, low and middle-income communities face food and housing insecurity, high unemployment, and a lack of affordable health coverage. The revenue from eliminating this tax break, which is projected to bring in about $155 million over the next three biennia, could be dedicated to crucial public health and healthcare services, such as funding healthcare subsidies and cost-sharing assistance to address our state's healthcare affordability crisis. Please improve equity in Washington's tax code and pass House Bill 1111. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we'll hear from Stacey Jones. And just so we know who's next, after that, like on deck, Tommy Gantz, Jeff Pack, and Mark Johnson. Go ahead, Stacey.
All right, thanks. Good afternoon. I'm Stacey Jones. I'm an economist and here today as a private citizen speaking in favor of House Bill 1111. The bill removes a tax break that exempts investment from the business and occupation tax. Removing the tax break is sound economic policy for three reasons. First, as Representative Cody pointed out, the bill adds needed transparency to Washington's economy. By requiring Washington's companies and nonprofits to report their investment receipts, just as they report their receipts for other business activities, the bill shines a light on the financial dealings of large companies and nonprofits. Second, removing the tax break on investment activities encourages businesses and nonprofits to put their resources to work. By removing a tax break for passive investment activities, the measure gives businesses and large nonprofits incentives to use their funds to expand their activities through investing in employees, equipment, and research rather than using their funds to generate income passively. Finally, removing the break is a small move toward greater fairness for Washington's tax system. It's well known that Washington's tax system is one of the nation's most regressive, with taxes falling disproportionately on lower income taxpayers. This measure helps to level the playing field a bit by removing a break that allows large organizations with enough extra cash to speculate on Wall Street to do so without paying taxes. 46 of the 50 states include investment profits in their business taxation. Washington instead gives these companies and nonprofits an unfair break on their investment profits. The legislature should act to remove an unusual and outdated exemption that encourages businesses and large nonprofits to speculate on financial markets at the ordinary taxpayer's expense. House Bill 1111 demonstrates a step in the right direction for Washington's tax system.
Thank you so much. And we'll hear from Tommy Gantz.
Thank you, Chair Frame, Ranking Member Orcutt, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tommy Gantz. I'm with the Association of Washington Business. Appreciate the opportunity today to speak on this bill. This exemption has been recognized as an important deduction and has existed in some form or another since the B&O tax was enacted in the 1930s. In a 2011 JLARC report, the Department of Revenue noted in a 1986 determination that the legislature's intention is not to tax the flow of capital between parent and subsidiary corporations. The repeal of this deduction would be inconsistent with the historical intent of the deduction, and it would also be inconsistent with the intent of the bill to tax additional profits. We believe doing so will result in double taxation of income earned and taxed in other states simply because the company is domiciled in Washington state. Should the state change its practices, the simple solution would be for such companies to move to any other state as acknowledged by the Department of Revenue in Part 2B of the fiscal note for this bill. Should that happen, Washington has the potential to lose revenue and lose jobs. More importantly, I sit on a PA board for the Museum of Flight, and I would like to point out that many of our cultural institutions, particularly in the performing arts sector and in the museum sector, rely on endowments and investment income from these endowments to keep people working. The Museum of Flight, for example, has received a wonderful endowment from a family that's allowed them to give away 28,000 memberships to children that are underprivileged. So I think it's a really good deduction, and it's not as nefarious as it's often portrayed, but it helps people too. And so I'd like to point out that that's important to these institutions. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. And next we'll hear from Jeff Pack.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Pack, and I represent a group called the Washington Citizens Against Unfair Taxes. Excuse me. Normally, I tend to appear more upon income taxes that relate to people and members of my particular group. So this one's a little bit of a different beast for me. I struggled a bit when this one first came across my desk. I struggled a little bit to understand exactly what it was, because when I first looked at it, it looked like it was sort of a backhanded income tax grab again. So listening to the introduction to it and spending a little bit more time looking at it, this really, to me, appears to be another of a whole slew of things that I see coming out of Olympia, which is basically somebody in Olympia sees a nice big fat red apple sitting there, and they want to, and the Olympia people that, you know, just love to tax people, there's this whole massive tax everything on the planet agenda, and this is just another big red apple that seems to be sitting there that people think that, oh well, you know, I want a piece of that. That's kind of really pretty much it, what I had to say on this. I'd like to mention one other thing. A lot of these hearings that I tend to sit at, also I hear oftentimes brought up about tax disparity. To be honest, when I hear that, it annoys the heck out of me, because tax disparity is caused by these tax and spend policies. And here you are, you're talking about taking money away from someplace that owned it and giving it to somebody else.
Thank you so much, Mr. Pack. And before we Before we hear from our next testifier, can we also call up Alicia Chapman, Timothy Reed, and Lynn McComb? Go ahead, Mark Johnson.
Thank you. Chair Frame, members of the committee, Mark Johnson, Senior Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs for the Washington Retail Association, representing over 4,500 storefronts throughout the state. Our members run in size from the sole proprietor to the world's largest. House Bill 1111 would eliminate the business and occupation tax deduction for all taxpayers except individuals for investment income. Many retailers and other businesses depend on investment income to keep their operations profitable and operating efficiently. This will fundamentally force businesses of all sizes to rethink how they are structured. Interestingly, and almost more troubling, is that this measure will impact thousands of nonprofits as well. Every service club with a foundation, every alumni association with a scholarship fund, every community nonprofit that depends on and budgets for investment income would have to pay the B&O tax on their earnings. If enacted, Washington State would become an outlier. Washington Retail respectfully asks that this bill does not move forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Johnson. And next we'll hear from Alicia Chapman. Oh, sorry, Madam Chair, it looks like we have a question.
I was going to say, are we moving on to our next panel?
We are. I'm just scrolling through.
Yep. All right. So let's go ahead and take a moment. Assistant Ranking Member Dufault, I see your hand up. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for anyone on the panel, but I'm just curious, when the prime sponsor first introduced the bill, she said that this kind of was to get at some hospitals that were using money to invest and take profits that way, and that was what she was trying to get at. But based on your testimony, it sounds like it's cutting a lot broader than that, that it would roll up any individual who has, you know, like one property owned in an LLC, or any nonprofit or charitable organization in the state, regardless of size, and that it's not just going to impact large hospitals, but that it could impact the smallest business that has any kind of interest or investment income that's owned in something other than their own name for liability protection or any other reasons. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think you're exactly right. It's if I can respond, Madam Chair, if it's okay. Yes, I think it's kind of a shotgun approach to a more rifled targets, and unfortunately, it does catch a lot of businesses, small ones too. Our business here, we have 15 employees, and this will impact us. We have investment incomes of our memberships, money, and a variety of investments, and that income helps support our operation as well. So it is a very broad swath, and thousands will be impacted that I think unintentionally will be drawn into this. So yes, I agree with your observation.
All right, let's keep moving on. I think the point's been made, and we have many more people signed up to testify. So let's go ahead and move forward. Vice Chair Berg, take it away.
Alicia Chapman will be next.
Good afternoon, members of the Finance Committee. My name is Alicia Chapman, and I'm the Executive Director of Mary Bridge Children's Foundation. I'm here to testify in opposition of House Bill 1111. We are very concerned that the legislature is considering eliminating the current tax deduction for investment income. Mary Bridge Children's Foundation is a separate 501c3 and works in partnership with Mary Bridge Children's Hospital to provide funding for services and initiatives that are generally not paid through government funding or payments from insurers. We estimate this bill would cost us around $50,000 per year. That amount is enough to cover salary and benefits of a SAB person, or more importantly, provide help to numerous families, and would be lost if this bill is passed. Foundations like ours play an important role as they raise and provide funding to improve access and equity by providing funding for critical items for underserved families, such as transportation vouchers, meals, medical equipment, car seats, and on-campus housing for families. These efforts are particularly important for Mary Bridge and its community as a safety net hospital with about 60% of our care provided to Medicaid enrollees. Our foundation funds more initiatives and services than I have time to mention today, but here are a few. Our Child Abuse Intervention Program, Kids Mental Health Pierce County, therapy services for some of our most fragile patients that exhaust their benefits early in the year. Treehouse, an on-campus housing for families to stay when NICU babies and children are in the hospital. As with most foundations that you've heard today, our funding is received through donations. Because donation giving can be variable, we place a portion of what we receive in investments to ensure that there's a reserve of stable funding to meet the needs when giving is lower.
Thank you.
These are not excess funds. We could easily spend all donations as they come in, but it's financially prudent to invest a portion of these donations to ensure the funds are available in a time of shortfall. After that, we receive is paid out along with any interest or investment income. If investment income is subject to B&O tax, that reduces the funding we have available to meet these needs.
Ms. Chapman, thank you so much. Chapman, yeah.
Thank you.
Perfect. Next, we'll hear from Timothy Reed.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Timothy Reed. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at Yakima Valley Memorial Hospital. I'm here to testify in opposition to House Bill 1111. As a nonprofit organization, Yakima Valley Memorial Hospital has no investors. All the revenues are used to provide services back to our community. This bill will make the task of caring for our community more challenging. Memorial's board of directors recently made the decision to remain an independent hospital after years of affiliation as a system. Remaining independent is financially challenging for us. We disagree with the bill's premise that the organization that earns investment income, dividends, interest, sales from stocks and bonds should now be required to be paying B&O tax on those that income. An investment portfolio allows us to invest funding with a return that goes directly to offset expenses from operations. These funds are critical to our ability to remain independent since our operating margin is already precariously thin at 0.2%. 74% of our patients are already on Medicare or Medicaid, both of which pay significantly less than the cost of care. This means we need to make up that loss from those programs. We do this through the payments, with contracts with commercial carriers, with those health plans, as well as revenue from non-patient healthcare services such as investments. If enacted, this bill would mean that Memorial would pay roughly $75,000 annually, which is a significant amount of money when we look at a very, very thin margin where every dollar counts. Our hospital also operates a foundation to raise money for the community. It serves children's needs and cancer needs. Last year, the foundation provided $2.6 million in donations. We're proud of the work to advance health equity in the community, and it includes diabetes wellness, childhood obesity prevention, and many other programs. The critical need for these programs are vital to us in taxing the foundation for that, so it would reduce the money available for those projects. I urge you to vote no on House Bill 1111. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Thank you. And before we hear from Lynn McComb, I also want to call up Blevin McCoy, Chris Bandoli, and Jessa Lewis. And next we'll hear from Lynn McComb. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn McComb, representing the Washington State Hospital Association. Want to point out a couple of facts that you need to take into consideration about the context of this bill. We've done a survey of all our hospitals, and I can find no other hospitals who have invested significantly in venture capital funds. So the example that is was used in the beginning is an extreme outlier. The second thing I would point out is that the the CARES funding that was provided by the federal government expressly prohibits measuring lost revenue, which would be qualified for CARES matching, expressly prohibits it from being anything other than revenue lost because of COVID. The third thing I would say is that the characterization of hospital sector profits is incorrect. When you look at, we did a survey of all our hospitals and compared 2019 revenues of all types with 2020 revenues of all types. In 2019, the net income of the entire hospital sector was $800 million. In 2020, the net income from the entire hospital sector was $80 million, a 90% reduction. The last point I would make is that one of the main sources or main reasons hospitals invest is to make sure that their cash does not deteriorate due to inflation. Hospitals must keep a certain amount of cash on hand to repay bond holders and to guard against crises.
Great.
And thank you so much. It doesn't seem like the right time to be trying to penalize.
Thank you.
I see we have a question. And just committee members, we have 9 minutes and six people to get through. So go ahead, Rep. Harris, Tally, with that in mind. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Frame. And with that in mind, Lynn, you're welcome to email this information back to us. But I would be curious for the spectrum of nonprofit hospitals that you noted you surveyed what the IRS tax statuses are, sort of the spectrum for an understanding of what those filings look like in consideration on the federal level. As a reference point for some of what you shared around investment. And if you also know sort of the margins of investment type, sort of how large of these investment types are we talking through? Because what you just said spoke to me a little bit, like our education institutions who make investments for the same reason. So trying to wrap my mind around that as well. Thank you.
Right. Thank you for offering to do the follow-up offline, Rep. Harris. Sure. I appreciate that. All right, Vice Chair Berg, I'll turn it over to you for our last testifiers here.
Yes, so we have Bevan McLeod up, and I'm just going to let our testifiers know I'm going to cut you off at right around a minute. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Bevan.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to try and be very quick. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bevan McLeod. I'm co-founder and president of Alliance for a Healthy Washington, testifying in support of HB 1111. Among many areas, COVID-19 shone a bright light on the inadequacies, unsustainability, and inequities of our healthcare system, both at the state and national levels. Here in Washington State, we are scrambling to find the revenue to fund just the basic needs of our public health infrastructure so that we can mitigate the social and human costs of this pandemic and the next, while supporting the needs of our public health workers so they can distribute vaccines appropriately. HB 1111 is an important tool in helping us get to where we need our state to go in addressing these public needs. As we've heard time and time again, we rank as one of the most unfair tax systems in the entire country. While our community health centers, small clinics, and critical access hospitals closed their door due to bankruptcy, many of the so-called nonprofit hospital systems are seeing astronomical profits come in from their Wall Street investments. Those same systems also use our roads and our schools and our public health infrastructure. They also need the vaccines and the health departments that keep our food supply clean. It is time that they pay into the public pot that we all rely on, and requiring a 1.5 to 1.75% tax on earnings from investments is just a drop in the bucket, but could mean the difference between a critical access clinic surviving or going bankrupt. Thank you. Please pass this bill.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your brevity. Next, we'll hear from Chris Bandoli.
Thank you, Vice Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. My name is Chris Bandoli. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Washington Healthcare Plans. We're signed in other on this legislation. So I'm sure you all know that health plans pay the premium tax for insurance business, but you might not know health plans also pay fairly significant B&O tax, whether they're for-profit or nonprofit, on non-insurance products and line of businesses that they may offer. So removing this deduction would impact the tax load paid by health plans. There are additional taxes directly on health plans being considered this legislative session, including to fund public health, which this bill, at least in part, has been talked about potentially doing. And so there's a lot of concern amongst my membership about the possibility of a layering of taxes that could result in a lot higher costs to our consumers down the line. That said, in the area of funding public health, we have been strong advocates for broad-based funding approaches. So to the extent that this bill is a potential vehicle for that, we would be interested in that conversation so long as we're avoiding layering of additional taxes. We've communicated that to the good sponsor of the bill, and we'd be happy to work with this committee on that going forward as well. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And next we'll hear from Jessa Lewis.
Greetings, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for taking the time to hear my testimony today. For the record, I am Jessa Lewis of Spokane, Washington, and a board member of Alliance for Healthy Washington, testifying in support of HB 1111. A recent WSU medical school study revealed Eastern Washington experiences higher age-adjusted mortality rates for every major cause of death, with the exception of overdoses, than those west of the Cascades. Recent hospital closures and bankruptcies are putting many rural communities at risk, especially in the light of COVID and the additional burden of long haulers like myself straining the system. Our populations are often burdened with lack of economic opportunity and can sometimes need to travel great distances for access to food and healthcare. I would like to highlight this passage from the bill. When companies and nonprofits have sufficient revenues to be able to make financial investments that generate additional profits, there's no need to give them tax breaks on those additional revenues. Instead of a break on investment income, that revenue can be used to fund basic needs of Washington. Nonprofit hospitals should put their funds into services and the community rather than financial markets. Thank you.
Great, thank you so much. And next we'll hear from Daniel Parkhurst.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Daniel Parkhurst. I'm the Director of Policy and Communications for Washington Nonprofits, the nonprofit association for our state. And I'm rising today to really try and understand more about this bill and its intent for the nonprofit sector as a whole. As you know, revenue from investments, while seemingly niche, are an important source of revenue for many nonprofits. Excluding foundations, one in five nonprofits nationally receives at least 5% of its income from investments. The major subsectors for that are arts and culture, education, healthcare, disease-related organizations, human services, and research institutes. And as the nonprofit association for our state, our members have been highly concerned about HB 1111 and what that will mean for them, especially at a time when nonprofits are having to do more with less. According to a recent UW report, nonprofits in our state are experiencing about a 30% decline in income, and certain subsectors are simultaneously experiencing a 30% increase in demand. And while we fully understand the need to close tax loopholes and to find revenue to fund critical public services, this really is a terrible time to be increasing the tax burden on all nonprofits. And so I'd really like to urge the committee to rethink the approach regarding the nonprofit sector. Thank you for your time.
And next we'll hear from Terry Standish-Kuhn. Go ahead, Terry.
Thank you, Vice Chair Berg, Chair Frame, Ranking Member Orcutt. I'm Dr. Terry Standish-Kuhn, President and CEO of Independent Colleges of Washington, signed in today as CON. All 10 of my member campuses have also signed in CON today. Independent Colleges of Washington urges state policymakers to reject this and any proposed tax on investment income earned by not-for-profit private colleges and universities. At a minimum, we ask that nonprofit higher education institutions specifically be exempted from the tax proposed in House Bill 1111. Together, our member campuses annually educate about 35,000 students. The majority of them are from the state of Washington. We serve an essential public mission that could be compromised by the implementation of the policy outlined in this bill. Private not-for-profit colleges operate with a small number of primary sources of revenue, net tuition, gifts, auxiliary services, and investment income. Earnings from endowed and other funds directly defray the cost of education for our students and improve college access. Non-tuition revenue is critical to the overall affordability for our students. As we read the bill, the state of Washington would impose a tax on investment earnings, including on the earnings we make on gifts to our universities. This may be an unintended consequence, and I have submitted written testimony. Thank you very much for the time.
And last, we'll hear from Thomas Neal. Go ahead, Thomas, if you can hear us. You've got a few seconds if you want to testify.
Thank you. My name is Thomas Neal, representing the Washington Society of CPAs. Washington Society opposes House Bill 1111. As has been testified, this impacts small and medium not-for-profits and their ability to continue to serve their their clients and the entities that they're impacting. But more importantly, this bill is drafted also impacts trusts and estates. By exempting only individuals, trusts and estates would also be subject to B&O tax. By taxing non-grantor trusts, there would be cases where surviving spouses would have to pay B&O tax on the investment returns they get from their deceased partner. For those charities and these surviving spouses, the complexity and having to file and pay B&O taxes is really beyond their ability at this time. This bill is drafted would discourage businesses from maintaining investment reserves, which are essential to surviving years such as we have just been through and are continuing to work through. We urge you to reject this bill. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right. I think, Vice Chair Berg, that's the end of our testimony. Do we have anything to read into the record?
That is the end of the testimony. We do have to read in 74 folks who did not risk to testify, 18 pro and 56 con.
All right. Thank you for that. And with that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 1111. We got everybody in on time. Congratulations. Thank you, everyone. And we are adjourned.